Wednesday, October 9th, at 7 p.m., she'll speak at the First Congregational Church in Corvallis, 4515 Southwest West Hills Road. And Thursday, October 10th, at 7 p.m., she'll be at Tabor Space on Southeast 55th and Belmont in Portland. Nicole Foss, writer and editor for theautomaticearth.org, is a big picture thinker and tours the world talking about environmental degradation and how we, as a community, can prepare ourselves and our neighbors for these realities. Nicole devotes a big chunk of her talks to practical suggestions for changes that people can make right now. That's Nicole Foss speaking October 9th at the First Congregational Church in Corvallis and October 10th at Tabor Space in Portland. More information can be found on the right-hand side of kbu.fm under Community Events.
The time is 5:01. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council examines the potential relocation of the Right to Dream 2 rest area to the Pearl District.
The Portland Police Bureau's Citizen Review Committee is deadlocked about whether to appeal a case of rude conduct by an officer to the City Council.
And the Oregon Supreme Court issues a ruling affecting protesters arrested during Occupy Portland.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 3rd, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Today, the Portland City Council is currently holding a hearing to discuss the future of the homeless rest area Right to Dream 2, which is slated to move from its current location to city-owned land under the west end of the Broadway Bridge. The hearing started at 2 p.m. and is expected to conclude later tonight. For more on the proposal, here's a clip of Portland Mayor Charlie Hales, the Portland City Attorney, and an official from the Bureau of Development Services.
We have, in the case of this particular organization, R2D2, a group of people who, to my mind, have proven some real ability to govern themselves, to solve public safety problems within their community, and to help make transition from homelessness to housing and back into the economy for quite a few people, and I'm impressed by that. Of course, we all know the evolution of this particular situation at 4th and Burnside involves some conflicts between the city and the property owner, and I want to particularly commend Commissioner Fritz for her hard work in trying to resolve that conflict and getting past that to a better day for the city and that property owner and for everybody else affected by that conflict and its twists and turns. So we're here to take up a particular question about R2D2 and the legal basis on which it can be moved from one place to another. But I hope to hear not only your opinions about whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, or whether the city's staff's legal reasoning is good or flawed, but I really want to hear today and later your ideas on how we as a community can do better. With that, let me ask our city attorney to ground us in the decision in front of the council.
Mayor Hales, members of the council, I'm Catherine Beaumont with the city attorney's office. For purposes of establishing a little framework, I'd like to describe the nature of today's hearing. It's not like the land use matters the council typically hears, in substance or in procedure. This is not an appeal hearing on a quasi-judicial land use review, and it's not a hearing on a legislative proposal to amend the city's comprehensive plan, zoning maps, or zoning code. What's before you today is a resolution to affirm and adopt the BDS director's recommended answers to questions about how the zoning code applies to a proposed use of property. Specifically, the director's been asked whether a rest area tent camp proposed to be located below the west end of the Broadway Bridge is allowed under the zoning code and whether any land use approvals are required. The director's recommended answers are that the proposed rest area is an allowed use and requires no design review or land use reviews. You are being asked to decide whether you agree with the director's interpretation and application of the zoning code. If a majority of the council votes yes on the resolution, it means that you do and are adopting his interpretations of the zoning code as your own. This will be the city's final decision on the questions answered in the zoning confirmation letter. However, adoption of the resolution is only a beginning, not an end. It answers general zoning questions about the proposed rest area, tent camp, and nothing more. There are many future steps that will need to be taken before the rest area can make the physical move to the proposed site. Those steps are not the subject of today's hearing.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales and Commissioners. My name is Rebecca Esau. I manage the Land Use Services Division at BDS. The Bureau of Development Services received two applications for a zoning confirmation letter for the site, for the same site and proposal. One application was from the Right to Dream 2 nonprofit corporation, and the other was from Williams, Dame & Associates. The applications each ask a series of questions about how the zoning code applies to a proposal for a rest area or campground managed by Right to Dream 2 at a site underneath the west end of the Broadway Bridge. The rest area or tent camp is expected to be at this location for up to 1 year, with 100 people staying there at any given time. Individuals may be located at the site for one night or longer. The rest area will be managed by Right to Dream 2, a nonprofit corporation. There will be electrical service, water service, gray water disposal, portable toilets, and a solid waste disposal area. Mass shelters and short-term housing are defined in the code, and BDS concluded that based on those definitions, what's being proposed is not either of those types of community service uses. The zoning code directs that uses should be assigned to the category whose description most closely describes the nature of the primary use. It is BDS's recommendation that the community services use category most closely describes the nature of this proposed use.
Okay, thank you very much. Now we're going to begin public testimony. Again, please try to confine your remarks to 2 minutes so we give everyone a chance to speak.
That was a clip of city officials setting the stage for today's hearing on the proposed move of the Right to Dream 2 homeless rest area. Early in the afternoon, public comments by many residents of Station Place Tower, located on the corner of Northwest Lovejoy and 9th, were overwhelmingly against the relocation of the homeless rest area, citing safety concerns.
Hi, my name is Ramona Odierna, and I live in the Station Place Tower. And I have just a couple questions I would like to know, and my questions are realistic because not all of us can afford the luxury to dream all the time. Some of us have to deal also with reality. And I would like to know from commissioners and from the mayor why this camp is constantly being misrepresented and romanticized when it is clearly not what they claim to be. All you need to do is look at their blog and pick their numbers apart, which are available to everybody. And if you get the percentage, then it's pretty clear that they've been rather a failure and not a success. And they claim to have served, where I'm not sure what the service entails, 25,000 people in a 21-month period. That translates to 38.9 new people every night. Now, Amanda, you claim that this is a stable situation. I would like to know from you, how is that a stable situation? We do know that among the homeless is a certain percentage of ex-convicts and especially sex offenders. I'm getting it from the Oregon State Police sex offender website here, that sex offenders who live in an unstable situation have a much higher likelihood of reoffending, and that would, of course, apply to living in a camp.
Hi, my name is Wade Varner. I'm with Homeless Against Homelessness in America, and I'm a formerly homeless veteran who spent 21 years on the streets, 11 of those sleeping rough. So yeah, I know what it is, and I'm not a child molester or a criminal. I was just a punk, a junk, and a drunk. And I needed somebody to give me the hand up. And people did. Burnside Projects gave me the drug and alcohol treatment that I needed to get to where I am today to open my nonprofit to help other people do what we do. If we simply pass the same measure that they have in Seattle and Eugene, where the small nonprofits like them and me and all the rest of the nonprofits that are around here can take in a few people in different places, but all we get is this NIMBY. That was pure NIMBY right there. Not in my backyard, please. We cannot have that happening in our city. Portland is not like that. Portland this is not the Portland that I grew up in, and I was born 30 blocks away from here 56 years ago. I spent 21 years out here on the streets of Portland, so I know what it's like to sleep rough, and it ain't no fun when you have people constantly waking you up, constantly harassing you, constantly putting the stress on it. That is against the constitutional rights, the human rights, and basic mean people suck. And let's not be the mean people. What is Portland? I mean, are we going to turn into South Carolina, where the city just turned 34 blocks of their downtown into a no homeless area? And they were going to bust them out and give them tickets if they don't? How much are we spending every time these guys ride a ticket? That could be, I mean, for the price that you're using the people that take care of the homeless, and the price that you're paying for the people that don't take care of the homeless, is about the same amount. If you simply took that money from trying to harass them and turn that into definite housing, 25 to 30 cents a day is all it takes to keep somebody in permanent supportive housing than it does to keep them homeless. Let's not be mean people here in Portland, please.
Thank you. Thanks, folks.
That was a clip of public comments from the city council hearing regarding the proposed move of the Right to Dream 2 homeless rest area. The hearing, which is currently in recess for the hour, is expected to end at 8 p.m. KBOO will have more on this developing story tomorrow.
Portland City Commissioner Steve Novick and the Portland City Council have voted unanimously to no longer make investments in Walmart until the year 2014. That is, unless the council votes to restart the investments. As part of the city's $876 million investment toward encouraging socially responsible decisions, the plan prohibits any financial exchange with the big box retailer. Novick had been discussing the idea with City Treasurer Jennifer Cooperman for 4 months. He stated he was aware the city could purchase more stock, but he had no idea the city was closing in on a $20 million investment during the same week of his proposal for a financial moratorium. The $20 million investment still stands, but has been determined to be unfavorable for municipal financial managers to sell the bonds for political reasons.
A ruling by the Oregon Supreme Court today established that a group of protesters arrested during Occupy Portland in 2011 are entitled to jury trials, court-appointed counsel, and other rights afforded in criminal trials. Due to the fact that prosecutors downgraded misdemeanor charges against the protesters to decriminalized violations with no threat of jail time, the state had argued that constitutional protections for criminal cases did not apply. In the case of the State versus Benoit, Justice David Brewer ruled that prosecutors couldn't deny those protections because of their initial decision to arrest on criminal charges rather than to issue citations, which he called, quote, a practical choice with legal consequences. Benoit is defendant Lori Ann Benoit, who was arrested in October 2011 on charges of second-degree criminal trespassing. Today's ruling is in agreement with another court decision made by a Multnomah County Circuit Court judge in February 2012. This afternoon, I spoke with Kevin Diaz, a lawyer with ACLU Oregon, for some legal background on the case. What are the constitutional protections that are available to defendants in criminal cases that the state argued in this case were not available in a civil case?
The issue or the provision of the Oregon Constitution that was at issue in this case was Article 1, Section 11 of the Oregon Constitution. And essentially that has to do with whether or not someone gets to go in front of a jury. So that was the issue here.
I read that there's a difference in the burden of proof between criminal and non-criminal proceedings, saying that in a criminal proceeding, proof of guilt must be beyond a reasonable doubt rather than a preponderance of evidence. Can you speak on that difference at all?
Well, I think in light of this decision, I think there's a serious question about whether or not the lesser standard still applies. I mean, what the court really said, at least on the narrow issue of whether or not they are these folks are entitled to a jury trial, is that you can't start out treating someone as a criminal and essentially starting a criminal proceeding with an arrest, booking, and incarceration, and then partway through that, change it to a civil violation without the consent of the person who's being prosecuted.
Who else could be affected by this ruling?
There are a lot of people. Actually, I think it was her and there may be up to 49 other folks that were being prosecuted that were arrested at the same time of the Occupy protests. And then there was a companion case that was also released today that had to do with someone who had been arrested for shoplifting, and it was downgraded to a violation. That's the Fuller case. So it can apply to... it seems like it's going to apply to quite a few different types of situations.
Does this decision follow existing legal precedent, or does it set a new precedent for similar cases either in Oregon or other states?
For Oregon, it really is a continuation of a case that was brought by the ACLU in the 70s, the Brown case. And that case had to deal, or dealt with, rather, whether or not certain driving while under the influence provisions were crimes or whether they were actually violations. And the court in that case essentially found that certain violations were really crime. And so this case, the Benoit case, extends that ruling.
And where do you foresee this case going from here in light of this ruling?
There are so many cases that this affects, you know, they'll probably be individual outcomes for each of those folks. As far as the Supreme Court is concerned, you know, the case is over, and so now it's going to go back to the trial court.
I've been speaking with Kevin Diaz with the ACLU of Oregon. This has been Jen Chavez for KBOO News.
The Portland Police Bureau could face a lawsuit based on accusations that they failed to follow up in a timely manner to allegations of sexual abuse of patients by an emergency room nurse at Legacy Emmanuel Hospital. There was a 3-month delay between the first complaint of sexual abuse against Jeffrey McAllister in January and the first action on the case in April. The woman, who was the victim of the January incident, claims that the officer who took her complaint was condescending and treated her, quote, like I was asking for it. It wasn't until April that she was contacted by a detective after another woman came forward with allegations against McAllister. McAllister was fired in April and faces several sexual assault charges involving 4 different victims. The woman who may now bring a lawsuit against the police bureau was assaulted by McAllister in February, and her tort claim takes the police to task for failing to act on the January complaint in time to prevent further assaults. She has also brought suit against Legacy Emmanuel for failing to take disciplinary action against McAllister for a past sexual abuse accusation back in September of 2012.
The Portland Police Bureau's Citizen Review Committee could not reach a decision Wednesday on whether to appeal the case of Floyd McCorvey to the City Council. McCorvey was stopped by Sergeant Todd Tackett and his trainee, Officer William Green, in Northwest Portland in April of 2012 after they spotted him talking with a woman at a bus stop. Tackett allegedly implied McCorvey was a pimp, denigrated his low-income housing situation, and accused him of smoking crack out of a pipe that Officer Green found in a body search, when in fact McCorvey had a medical marijuana card and the pipe was legal. The officers eventually cited him for jaywalking. The police bureau initially dismissed the accusations against Tackett for lack of evidence, and McCorvey appealed through the Citizen Review Committee for the first time in August. For more on the case and the appeals process in general, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch.
Back in August, they did reach a 4-2 vote to recommend that the police bureau reconsider its earlier finding that the officers did not require disciplinary treatment over their treatment of Floyd McCorvey.
Right. That was very carefully worded. That's true. That he didn't require any disciplinary treatment. With the finding is very confusing because this is an administrative process, so the outcomes are not like a court where it's you win or you lose. There's also a middle ground called unproven, and with these administrative findings, and the finding of the bureau was unproven, meaning it's possible that the officers treated Mr. McCorvey discourteously, which was the allegation they investigated. But they didn't have enough evidence, they said, to prove it. The CRC voted, as you said, 4-2 in August to say, well, we do think it was discourteous. The chief came back and said he disagreed, and he did some pretty unpleasant things, the chief, in his letter back to the CRC, and said, I want to keep the original finding of unproven with a debriefing, and I'm not going to sustain this against the officer.
So the police bureau did respond to that CRC vote then. Are they required to do that, or is it just a recommendation that they do it?
When the CRC makes a recommended finding, they send it to the bureau, and the bureau has to respond. So the bureau can respond by saying, we agree with you, we're going to sustain this complaint against the officer, and we're going to discipline him appropriately. Or they can do what they did last night, which is called a conference committee, where the bureau comes back and tries to convince the CRC to change their vote. And they got one member to change her vote, which is unfortunate. In the past, when the CRC has made a vote like that and the bureau came back to try to convince them elsewise, it ended up creating a unanimous vote to send it to city council, because even the members who didn't agree with the original finding felt, well, this is what our committee agreed on, and we want to go to city council with this. I don't know why that didn't happen last night. Instead, it ended up being, as you said, a split vote. And even though the city attorney implied that they needed a majority to take action one way or the other, the chair of the CRC just declared that the matter was ended.
What would happen if the case had gone to the city council?
It would have been a very interesting experience, because there's only been one case in the entire history of the Citizen Review Committee that's gone before city council, and that was in 2003. It's like about a year after it started up. Our system has a very unique structure in the way that our five elected officials get to hear a case of police misconduct and vote on whether or not the officers were out of policy. And supposedly, and I won't get into the details of it, but supposedly their word is final. Whereas the CRC is just recommending to the police chief what to do. If the council votes on it, theoretically, the bureau has to do what they say. So I think it would have been a great exercise, especially with a case like this, which is clearly about racial profiling, even though it wasn't investigated as such, for that case to go before city council. Unfortunately, at this point, that's not what's happening.
Is this McCorvey's last chance for this? Is there more of an appeal process that he can?
Well, there's nothing he can do further with his case, with the administrative part of his case. It is possible for the CRC to reconsider their vote, but they have to work off new information. And somebody alerted me that the officer in a case, the training officer, which is Officer Todd Tackett, had been involved in an incident about 6 years ago with a young man who has autism, 15-year-old African-American named Sir Millage, who got tasered and beaten at least six times with a baton because he was wandering around downtown after he had kind of escaped from his home. Todd Tackett was on the scene. I don't think he was either the baton wielder or the person with the taser, but he was involved in this rather unsightly incident. And the chief's argument to the CRC about why they should believe the officer over Mr. McCorvey was, oh, the officer has a clean record, he's never done anything wrong, and we promoted him to be a sergeant, but look, Mr. McCorvey has a long criminal history. Most of the stuff about Mr. McCorvey's history and everything about Officer Tackett's history was not part of the original record that led to the CRC's original finding. So there were some shenanigans that I think went outside what the proper process is, and I'm hoping that they will reconsider their vote based on the pieces of information that they didn't have at the time they voted last night.
Dan, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch.
Yesterday, the Oregon State Legislature passed a compromise bill that includes a provision known to its critics as Oregon's Monsanto Protection Act. As KBOO's Paul Rowland reports, the bill's passage is not deterring the campaign against genetically modified agriculture here in Oregon.
A special session of the Oregon State Legislature yesterday passed a sweeping bill attempting to prevent the enactment of local laws regulating agricultural practices. Senate Bill 863, which was included in a five-bill package dealing mostly with taxes and pensions to address the state's fiscal crisis, passed both the House and Senate by a fairly wide margin. Although the bill does not actually mention genetically modified crops or organisms, critics say it was introduced at the behest of out-of-state agrochemical corporations like Monsanto and Syngenta, which are heavily invested in genetically modified agriculture. The bill prohibits any local laws or measures for regulating the display, distribution, growing, harvesting, labeling, marketing, mixing, notification of use, planting, possession, processing, registration, storage, transportation, or use of agricultural seed, flower seed, nursery seed, or vegetable seed, or products of agricultural seed, flower seed, nursery seed, or vegetable seed. A growing movement of local activists and some elected officials has begun attempting to pass ordinances either through initiatives or local governments to ban genetically modified organisms in agriculture, and it looks like Oregon may become a key battleground. There are currently efforts to get such initiatives approved for the ballot in both Lane and Benton counties. A similar initiative already passed in Jackson County and is exempted from the bill approved yesterday. Earlier today, I spoke with Ann Nieland with Support Local Food Rights in Eugene and an attorney representing Chief Petitioner Lynn Bowers of the Local Food System Ordinance Initiative of Lane County. Obviously, this was somewhat expected, this bill by the legislature to limit the ability to do what you all are trying to do. What reaction do you have now that it's passed?
Yes, like you said, it was fully anticipated by our group that the corporate interests at work would try to stop our local effort to pass a law addressing local agriculture. And we will press ahead with our initiative despite the passage of this piece of legislation because we see it as a direct attack on democracy. It is a law that's been written by corporations to advance corporate interests at the expense of the people's right to vote. And our initiative, on the other hand, is about building the people's voice and exercising our right to address laws affecting our local agriculture. And we intend to proceed with that effort.
So where do you see it going from here?
Well, right now we have our initiative is working its way through the county system. We anticipate moving on to the ballot title phase and then getting permission to collect signatures. And we will proceed with that effort. We do anticipate legal pushback from the corporations that oppose this and that passed Senate Bill 863. But we will continue to push for our local democratic right to address matters that we care about. And we'll stand firm in our principles that corporations shouldn't be making laws in our state and that instead the people should be.
I read that this Senate Bill 863 includes an emergency clause that would allow it to take immediate effect. In fact, trying to preclude efforts just like those in Benton and Lane County. So could you just explain sort of legally what you think will happen as you go through the initiative process? Just tell us how you think it's going to come down.
Well, to be honest, it's not totally clear to us, I think, at this moment how it will come down. Like I said, we'll continue with our initiative and attempt to get it on the ballot, although we do expect corporate pushback trying to exercise the Senate Bill 863, even though it's taken effect immediately. We don't know how they'll respond to it with respect to our initiative at this time. But we are prepared, the way our initiative is drafted, to frontally challenge preemption, which this 863 is, a preemptive law, and to challenge other corporate constitutional rights. And so we'll continue to stand firm in our value that the people have the right to make laws that are more powerful than the right for corporations to do so.
Well, Thomas Lindsay was here of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, who's sort of one of the initiators of this kind of effort by communities to affirm their rights against corporate interests. And he was almost in effect saying, we'll bring it on, because he anticipates this kind of thing happening over and over again as communities stand up for their rights. But where In your understanding, where do you see the fight really playing out? You know, is it going to go through the courts? Do you have any ideas? Are there precedents for this?
I'm not aware that there are precedents, because what we are trying to do is to engage the system in a challenge in which the people's rights are taking on corporate rights. And so I think in that respect, it's a novel challenge. And I think that's why Thomas Lindsay welcomes this type of situation where corporations continue to secure their rights through state legislatures and state law. And it sets the people up to be able to point to the fact that corporations are running our government and passing laws that suppress our rights as the people. And so we are looking to expose that for what it is. We encourage people to just engage in a further understanding of what this legislation represents in terms of an assault on our democracy, and to really engage the system in saying that we aren't going to accept this as a practice in our democracy.
And I was speaking with Ann Nealand from Eugene, with a support local food rights group and one of the supporters of the initiative to ban genetically modified organisms from local agriculture in Lane County. And with KBOO News, this is Paul Rowland.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview by KBOO's Miles Bryan with Portland Bitcoin Group digital asset expert Stephen Wagner in the aftermath of yesterday's FBI seizure of the online drug website The Silk Road. Wisdom of the Elders follows at 6, and at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will begin as mostly cloudy, but gradually give way to sunny skies and a high near 66 degrees. Tomorrow night we'll see increased clouds and fog and lows dropping to around 45 degrees.
It's 5:32, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Some aspects of American agriculture are quite odd. For example, to meet a farmer these days, there's no need for you to venture out to the hinterland, because thousands of them actually are city slickers. And they're really slick, for many of them neither plant nor harvest wheat, cotton, peanuts, or any crops at all. Rather, relaxing in their often luxurious urban nests, they farm the federal farm bill, harvesting millions of dollars each year from taxpayers. A new report from the Environmental Working Group reveals that more than 18,000 people living in America's 54 largest cities pocketed about $24 million last year from the Ag Department's direct payment program. New York City, for example, has 152 of these farmers. San Francisco, 116. Chicago, 393. Denver, 821. Tampa, 100. Tucson, 328. And Houston, 1,405. That's because the program makes payments not only to real farmers, but also to people who merely hold an ownership interest in farmland, whether or not any crops are raised on it, and even if the city-dwelling recipient has never visited the place. Ironically, this cockamamie payment scheme was put into the 1996 Farm Bill as a transition measure to wean farmers off subsidies. But it's been renewed twice, and it looks like our gridlocked Congress is about to do it again, even though it pays zero to the majority of America's farm families. Indeed, the bulk of the $5 billion paid out annually goes to the biggest spreads, including multi-million dollar corporate operations. This is Jim Hightower saying, even if Congress creditors finally muster the political gumption to stop this absurdity, they intend to replace it with a more bizarre crop insurance scam that's a guaranteed income program for multimillionaires. For more information, go to ewg.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Some federal workers, frustrated by government orders to shut down, have rebelled by working for free. Washington, D.C. Mayor Vincent Gray declared that all city employees were essential, ensuring trash would be collected and the remaining 32,000 federal employees will still have jobs. The so-called rebels say they are drawing inspiration from World War II veterans who, a day ago, broke barriers and cut tape so they could visit a memorial in Washington, D.C. After seeing the same report about the veterans, Rob Miller, manager of Pisgah Inn, which is located on national park land in North Carolina, is defying the shutdown order and keeping the inn open to his 78 guests. Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, also defied an order from the National Park Service, claiming that most of their funding comes from the state. In an interview with USA Today, DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp said that, quote, "Sometimes we have to rise above and beyond and get that work done."
California Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill earlier today that grants undocumented immigrants the right to obtain a driver's license. The bill allows approximately 2 million Californians to now drive legally. The signing of this bill is a victory for California immigrant rights advocates who have been pushing for this reform for decades. The bill's author, Democratic Assemblyman Luis Alejo of Watsonville, called the outcome historic for all immigrant communities. Prior to 1993, citizenship was not required for a driver's license in California. Though undocumented immigrants can legally obtain an ID card for driving, the card does not establish eligibility for employment or for voting or for seeking public benefits. The licenses will be marked to indicate that they cannot be used as identification for federal purposes. Currently, only 10 other states allow undocumented immigrants to obtain a license. A bill in Oregon granting undocumented residents the right to a driver's license was signed into law this past May. The law has met with opposition by some Oregon residents, including a group called Protect Oregon Driver Licenses, who seek to overturn the ruling.
A recent study suggests airborne pollution is disrupting honeybees' pollination activity. The British study, published in the journal Scientific Reports, found that diesel exhaust interferes with the floral odors plants release to attract pollinators. Diesel air pollutants confuse honeybees, which depend on their sense of smell, to forage. Researchers identified a chemical known as mononitrogen oxide, or NOx, as the main culprit. Flowers exposed to NOx have an altered scent profile, which prevents bees from recognizing them as food sources. Colony failure and pollination cycle disruption is possible if honeybees are unable to detect food sources. The honeybee population is already declining drastically, and it's estimated that in the past 30 years, the bee population has dropped by 50%. As the world's primary pollinators, the bee population decline threatens global food security. The researchers claim their findings are proof that air quality must be improved.
France's socialist-controlled National Assembly recently dispatched a mission to New Caledonia to convince the territory to hold a referendum on independence by the year 2019. The New Caledonia Archipelago, a French territory in the South Pacific, has the 12th highest per capita income in the world, higher than Germany, the UK, or France itself. The French political left, however, may not be happy with the results of the proposed referendum. KBOO's Michael Jean Horowitz reports from Noumea.
Colonialism in the South Pacific? That's so 19th century. And yet, New Caledonia, Tahiti, and Wallace remain overseas territories of France, while Eastern Samoa remains a modest territory of the U.S. But socialist governments in France, through the Matignon and Noumea Accords, have compelled New Caledonia to hold a referendum on independence by 2018. And with national elections expected next spring, the prospect of independence is being debated in the territories only daily. On a recent visit to Noumea, I spoke with three players: Christophe Chouin, managing editor of The Daily, Vaya Froguier, communications director for the movement to keep Caledonia in the Republic of France, and Ilaisane Laouvea, a spokesperson for the socialist National Liberation Front of the indigenous Melanesian people, the Kanaks, one of whose traditional chorus opened this report. After over a century and a half of colonization, the Kanaks are now a minority in their homeland. With intermarriage, it's difficult to categorize, but 40% of Caledonia is thought to identify as Kanak, nearly 30% as European, 10% as Polynesian, with smaller minorities from Melanesia and Southeast Asia. When I suggested to Joanne that colonialism was passé, he reminded me that France was moving beyond it.
France is slowly transferring a lot of powers to New Caledonia. Education, law is transferred to New Caledonia. So New Caledonia is making its own laws, making its system of education.
Rogier agrees there have been
transfers of powers from France, and that's quite important because that's moving towards an autonomous regime rather than a colonial regime.
Having granted some home rule, one might wonder why France doesn't divest entirely. Yet Rogier argues independence would imperil Caledonia.
The main reason why most people in New Caledonia do not want to break away from France is for protection purposes. We hold the second largest resource in nickel mining in the world. If we were to be independent, we are way too small to protect ourselves. The Chinese could come over tomorrow and broker whatever deal. The Brazilians could come over and do the same thing.
But the Liberation Front counters that independence need not spell isolation.
L'indépendance ne veut pas forcément dire s'inscrire dans une rupture totale.
Independence doesn't necessarily mean signing up for a complete break with France. If we achieve it, it may require forging relationships that can placate the fears we have. Caledonia must become a state capable of both maintaining and resisting international relationships, a state that can join the concert of nations while retaining the means to negotiate with its members.
Rogier and the Front also disagree about the lesson of Vanuatu, France's former colony in Melanesia, just to the northeast. Rogier suggests Vanuatu hasn't developed competently since obtaining independence in 1980.
I mean, you can see today the difference between Vanuatu and New Caledonia. I mean, one has got difficulties moving forward and generating economic growth. I mean, their main industry is tourism. They have 10 times more tourists than New Caledonia, and yet they have trouble creating any riches for their people.
Lau Ovea replies the comparison is unfair, inasmuch as New Caledonia sits on valuable nickel deposits, while Vanuatu is largely barren of resources.
La Calédonie n'est pas le Vanuatu. La Calédonie n'est pas Fiji non plus.
New Caledonia is not Vanuatu. It's not Fiji. If we take the example of Vanuatu, I believe its budget is for the most part composed of foreign aid. It's absolutely not comparable with New Caledonia. And if nowadays Vanuatu is being gobbled from all sides, it's because it doesn't have the means to resist. New Caledonia, however, has the means to become a real state.
Kanak turnout has been poor in national elections, so it's difficult to predict the outcome of a referendum. But barring an upsurge, it's hard to imagine electoral support for independence topping 40% over the next 5 years. Tolerance of French sovereignty is partly due to a widespread, if uneven, rise in standard of living, tacit support of a majority of Asian and Polynesian minorities, and the granting of limited home rule, even if all judges continue to be dispatched from France and the Noumean police seem mostly of European origin. With the Weta group of Lefaux Island briefly bookending this report, this is Michael Jean Horowitz in Noumea for KBOO Pacific News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Sean Stewart, Rebecca Ney, Robin Ryan, Nell Gagnon, John Cooper, and Jeff Love. The producer is myself, Jen Chavez. Special thanks to Paul Roland and Michael Horowitz. Our engineer is Rebecca Ney. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503 526-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jen Chavez.
I'm Robert Barncourt. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, hosts Ani and Lynn speak with local activist Dan Handelman about this Saturday's forum called No More Afghanistan's The Cost of Endless War. At 9, APA Compass presents an audio postcard from the Congressional Gold Medal Tribute. Medal recipients Shige Imai and Roy Matsumoto explain their different roles as Japanese-American soldiers in the U.S. military during World War II. We will hear how music was used to restore a sense of normalcy to the internees, and former camp singer Chiki Ishihara White relates her family's internment-era experiences. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on It Takes a Village, host Shahid Hamid hosts a show called Confessions of a Reformed Gangbanger, The Turnaround. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Paula Small speaks with members of the local African American Health Coalition, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting and improving health and wellness in Oregon's Black and African American community and beyond. A big thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support, and thanks for listening to your community radio station. Stay tuned now as KBOO's Miles Bryan explores the aftermath of yesterday's FBI seizure of the online drug website, The Silk Road. Good night, Jen.
Good night, Robert. Good night.